Long before the National Security Agency's controversial data collection programs were made public, there was a robust debate in this country about what privacy is and who's entitled to it and whether it's even something we should insist on. The New Yorker's Jill Lepore chronicles our complicated relationship with the subject in her latest article, The Prism, Privacy in an Age of Publicity, in the June 24th issue of The New Yorker. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hello.
Hey.
You begin your piece by discussing the Mazzini affair in 1844. What are the particulars of that case?
Yeah, I was reading the news and I was like, oh my God, this is just like the Mazzini affair. It's not really just like the Mazzini affair, but the Mazzini affair happened in England in 1844. Giuseppe Mazzini is just a very important Italian revolutionary who had been sentenced to death in absentia and had spent years in prisons and was living in exile in London when he began to suspect that someone was reading his mail. It arrived with the stamps funnily affixed, and his mail seemed to be always late. And so he became convinced that the government was opening his mail.
And he did a test.
And he did a test. I think this is just brilliant. I wish there was a way to check your email in this way. He sent a bunch of letters to himself and also some as a control to friends of his, and in all the envelopes he put different tiny objects like grains of sand or strands of hair or poppy seeds, and sent all the letters out, and his mail arrived much later than all of his friends' mail, and his friends' mail, when you opened up the envelopes, out spilled the poppy seeds. But when he opened up his own mail, which seemed to be sealed, there was nothing in it. I mean, there were little letters, but there were none of these tiny little granular objects that he had placed in them. So he became convinced that someone was in fact reading his mail. He felt he had proven it, and he talked to a friend of his who was a member of Parliament, who brought this question to the Home Secretary, who said, "I can't answer that question. The answer is a secret." And so began a great investigation in Parliament in 1844. A committee of secrecy was formed to investigate whether, in fact, the government was opening people's mail. And it turned out, as was revealed by the committee of secrecy, that there was such a thing as the secret department of the post office. And they were not only reading Giuseppe Mazzini's mail, but had been reading people's mail occasionally using warrants. Again, you know, it had a legal stamp of approval upon it. And this had gone back centuries.
And what was the public's response? Were they shocked?
But the public was pretty shocked and surprised. You know, Britain, in the early 19th century, as today, and here in the United States as well, prides itself on a certain kind of transparency and openness that was a fairly new value to be celebrated. But so too new was a whole new kind of fetish for privacy. And these two things came into conflict over the Mazzini affair and have been in conflict ever since, although they've shifted a great deal since then.
Well, Benjamin Disraeli quipped about the scandal. "They," meaning government officials, "may open all my letters provided they answer them." Have we heard similar things about the NSA recently, from influential opinion makers like Thomas Friedman and Bill Keller in the New York Times?
Sure, and people have a range of views about the, you know, what is always presented to us as some kind of a balance that we need to arrive at between our needs for privacy and the need for security, right? And people can have a different sense of where the fulcrum is on that balance, right? So some people say it's okay for the government to open our mail, or in a virtual sense, virtually open our mail, so long as we are notified that indeed takes place. And other people say it's not okay under any circumstances. Some people believe it's okay with a more rigorous standard for the granting of a warrant. I mean, there are a range of views, but all of these emerge from a very complicated historical tradition that we are easily seduced into believing is completely determined by the technology, right? Like, I think everybody is wrapped up. I mean, I myself, I'm easily wrapped up in the idea that, oh, this is just so interesting because it's brand new, because we didn't have the internet before. But it's not brand new, right? The matter of what the relationship is between the privacy that I might cherish and the secrecy that the government itself might cherish for its own political purposes and diplomatic ends is something that does stretch far back in time.
Well, President Obama has defended controversial programs like PRISM by saying that they have struck the right balance between privacy and security. But why have these two terms come to be seen as in opposition to one another? Is this a recent development?
Well, the notion question of privacy, there's a tremendous and really terrific historical scholarship on the history of privacy, because although you may think that privacy is eternal as a kind of human value, it's really not. Privacy doesn't emerge culturally before the rise of individualism, and it doesn't really become a very central cultural tenet until the emergence of a middle class. So it's really something that we associate with the 18th and 19th century, with the rise of industrialization, and also with universal literacy, or tremendous leaps in literacy. And so privacy affixes itself to what is then written, which has a different kind of, we have different claims to privacy on things that are written down, which is almost like a letter is what breaches your soul. Like, it's a thing that moves, that exposes your brain, you know, in the same way that we might feel exposed by what we put on a text, right? A piece of mail in the 19th century had that same valence. So that in itself is new, right? This just doesn't go that far back. So there's not like centuries of tension between privacy and security, right? The national security state is really a kind of Cold War development, and that's its own kind of separate history. But what's interesting to me about the long historical trajectory is that, in my view, or the way I've kind of come at puzzling through this issue, because people have a kind of almost visceral sense of their right to privacy, right, which I think actually has to do with the secularization of mystery, like that there used to be some notion that there were things that are unknown in the world and they're miraculous and they can only be known by God. There's this kind of complicated historical process in which, like, what is most unknown is who you are, your very self. And so there's almost a sort of a religious zeal around privacy that has affixed itself to ideas of privacy. And there's a similarly great intense fervor around security at this particular historical moment, and certainly there was during the Cold War as well. So there's a great, sort of interesting historic, like, WWF battle going on right here.
Laws have been enacted to protect our secrecy. Had they been in place in England during the Mazzini affair, what was the government trying to find out about him?
He was trying to unify the kingdoms and states of Italy and form a unified Italian Republic. This is before Italy is a country. And he was hoping that a revolution in Italy would spark a series of revolutions across Europe that would themselves liberate the people from monarchy. So he was very much a revolutionary. He was also a literary critic and was many other things. But the government of Britain was obliging the ambassador of Austria in opening Mazzini's mail, because hoping that to discover whether there was any plot in effect that would destabilize Austria. The outrage about the opening of the mail was so profound, and it's basically called un-English, that the secret department of the post office was abolished as a result of the scandal. So there was a great kind of defensiveness around the need, but it wasn't Britain's security that was really in question, right? It was sort of the opening of the mail of a foreign national whose politics many people in England were very sympathetic with. So that particular circumstance was different.
I'm speaking with Jill Lepore, who is a professor of American history at Harvard. And also a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her article, The Prism Privacy in an Age of Publicity, is in the June 24th issue of The New Yorker. Well, we're hearing about these two poles. On the one hand, an interest in maintaining privacy and laws enacted. On the other hand, an interest in maintaining secrecy. And I'm assuming that's been a feature of people in power ever since they started doing things that they didn't want us to know about.
Yeah, but what I think is really the most interesting tension at this moment, I mean, the privacy versus security is maybe at the forefront of the political conversation. But for me, the more profound cultural tension is between privacy and publicity. That is to say, if you think about, you know, in 1890, Samuel Warren and Louis Brandeis, who were Boston lawyers together, wrote this seminal article, The Right to Privacy, that was published in the Harvard Law Review, in which they said, because Warren had been so troubled by publicity about his family life in Boston and Washington newspapers, there is such a thing as a right to privacy. That is to say, we have a right to be let alone. And what we need to be let alone from here was not government intervention per se, although they were concerned about that, was the attention of the press. That we have, the privacy was defined by Warren and Brandeis as the right to be hidden from the attention of the media. And so it becomes something else, very much something else, as it operates through the court, that principle of the last century and some. But really, it's very much about the tension between privacy and publicity, and a whole new meaning of publicity. And so that's the piece, if you were to think about that at this particular moment now, that's the tension between we want to have our stuff on Facebook, but we don't want Facebook to give it to anybody. That's sort of the piece of, like, the self-publicizing that is a big feature of how many people live on the Internet.
Before Louis Brandeis was named to the Supreme Court, he and Samuel Warren published a book called The Right to Privacy, and they wrote, "Instantaneous photographs and newspaper enterprise have invaded the sacred precincts of private and domestic life, and numerous mechanical devices threaten to make good the prediction that what is whispered in the closet shall be proclaimed from the housetops." That sounds like warnings we hear today about complex algorithms used by the NSA and data mining companies. So has every technological advancement made snooping on each other easier?
No, I mean, it was pretty easy to snoop in the 19th century too. I think that the technological change, while vast and furiously fast, is a bit of a distraction from the real cultural change that underlies it. I mean, when you think about that article that Brandeis and Warren wrote, Brandeis's family fled Austria in 1848, 4 years after the Mazzini Fair, when the revolution that they hoped that Mazzini would himself create in Austria failed, and they were being persecuted as a result of it. Like, Brandeis knew that story. The story about the intrusion into one's mail and one's personal and private life being broadcast somehow, not necessarily gathered by the government, although that's one feature of the argument, but possibly broadcast, you know, shouted from the rooftops instead of whispered in the closets. It's a very eloquent article, but the way that it is come to operate in our culture at large today, I think, misses out the paradox of a culture in which the only thing that we seem to prize more than privacy is publicity.
Now, when he was on the Supreme Court much later in his career, Brandeis heard the case Olmstead versus the United States, which dealt with the constitutionality of wiretapping. And what did the court decide, and what did Brandeis say in his dissent?
The court decided so Olmstead was this former Seattle police officer who was a bootlegger, and his telephone had been tapped to get information that was used in his conviction. He was sentenced to 4 years hard labor. He was convicted. He appealed the conviction. The Supreme Court upheld it. His attorneys had argued that the wiretapping violated the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, but Brandeis, in his dissent, said, what really is going on here is that the wiretapping violates this right to privacy. And the reason we need to stand up against this and defend this right is that we cannot even know, we can't yet predict the chain of the unending chain of machines that will be available for us in the future, for the government in the future to invade our privacy. That they wouldn't even necessarily have to come into our house and attach a tap to our phone line. Who knows? Who knows what could, you know, so that's what Brandeis comes across as incredibly prophetic, largely because he was quite careful, and he was one of the most scholarly men ever to sit on the bench and wrote these just luminous decisions and opinions that undertook a great deal of research. And Brandeis considered every brief that he wrote to be a form of public education. So they resonate today because we meant them to resonate.
Now, as you mentioned, polls about NSA stooping and programs like PRISM have indicated that we have a mixed set of views in this country. Is it your sense that many people today wouldn't mind it if a postal worker opened up and read their handwritten letters?
Oh, that's a great question. Someone should do a poll.
Well, are notions of privacy changing? Because, as you said, we post so many things on Facebook and Twitter, and we assume that a lot of people are privy to what we're thinking and saying and doing in our lives.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to try to figure out quantitatively how to get at that. That is to say, how to get at that shift and where people draw the line. You know, what is the wall of my house now, right? Like, what people are upset about in the 19th century, like the little slot in your door. You know, I have a house where my front door has this mail slot in it, and it's just so symbolic, right? Like, that's the breach of your privacy when the mail comes in and the mail goes out.
And we don't read other people's mail.
we have a membrane, a very thin membrane, right, that separates us, our private from our public lives, in many respects. sort of an in all directions. And we haven't made that cultural adjustment. I mean,
Jill,
you can measure it in all kinds of ways, in changes in the language. Like the word publicity used to mean transparency.
Jill Lepore's article, The Prism, Privacy in an Age of Publicity, is in the June 24th issue of New Yorker. Thank you so much, Jill.
Hey, thank you.